righty. Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lee Merritt, once an orthopedic and spinal surgeon, now a professional medical rebel and the doctor the FDA warned you about. And my co-host today is Courtney Turner from the Courtney Turner Podcast. And we have two sponsors today that we'd like to bring on, RNC. These are the B17, the good apricot seed people. The B17 is rnstore.com/dangerous to improve your immunity. And that basically helps a lot of things that the FDA doesn't want us to talk about. But trust me, this is good stuff. And also, we have a new sponsor, defythegrid.com/dangerous. Now, this is American produced goldbacks. There are, I can't remember, 7 or 8 states now where these are being produced. I actually had one. I'll bring it to the next show. And it's just a small, every bill is bigger because it's actually got gold in it. And so there's intrinsic worth to the bill. And my friend Robert Scott Bell, he actually uses this at the local hardware store where he is. So this is one of the ways out, I think, of our mess that we're in with false fiat currency. So some interesting things about this, but there's some pictures of the bills. They're beautiful bills. You ought to have just a few just for a collectible, because who knows where these are going to go. But this is really, it's a new concept, but think about it. You can't take an ounce of gold and go down and buy bread. Well, we don't want you eating bread. Buy fruit in the grocery store. So this is the answer. We have to have small fractions of gold. So anyway, thank you for joining us. And don't forget to use the code DANGEROUS for all your purchases. And today we're going to be talking about land patents. And to introduce our guests, Courtney, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I'm all super excited about this. So as we know from the previous shows, I was talking about the natural asset companies that they were trying to do this 30 by 30 grab. You know, where they were going to propose a rule with the SEC to put these natural asset companies on the New York Stock Exchange. And then we did one where we're talking about the smart commodity projects, where the USDA announced that they were going to put $3.1 billion into smart commodity projects, climate smart commodity projects, sorry. And so...
And that's basically buying the air and water around our property, over our properties, right?
The NACS is buying the air, the water. Yeah. They're commodifying air, water, land, mineral photosynthesis. The climate smart commodity projects is those are about monitoring and tracking and being able to measure the greenhouse gas emissions. Because in 2022, the SEC proposed a rule that all companies have to report ESG. And the farmers pushed back on this. Well, I don't have any way of measuring my ESG. And that was when the USDA announced 5 months later that they were going to invest $3.1 billion into the Climate Smart Commodity Project. So, so that led to what are some ways that we can get out of this so that we can actually own the land? Because they are trying, this is part of the 30 by 30 agenda, which is a stepping stone to the half earth agenda. And this is the idea, half earth is where only half the earth's water and land can be inhabited or utilized by humans. It's part of a degrowth agenda where they don't want, and they're calling it low yield or no yield, and they don't want any production on the land, which means no farming, no drilling, no use of, no breathing probably, because, you know, we exhale carbon dioxide. We're the carbon they want to reduce. So these guys are from the American Meeting Group, and Ron Gibson and Robert Williams, and they have way more knowledge in this, how to do land patents. They're not actually even called land patents, but I don't think, or they might be in this country. But
oh yeah, I have that book.
Yes, that's what you're saying. You have the book.
It's underlined.
So we'll bring them on because they know way more about this. I had a lovely chat with Robert yesterday on the phone, and he's a wealth of information. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. Bring them both on. Awesome.
I have land. I want to preserve it.
That's a good. That's a good thing to be inspired by, and it's a mighty work, and it is like core foundational work.
Yeah, absolutely. But so maybe for the audience, you could give a little backstory about who you are, what you do, and how did you get involved in doing this? in the American
My background is in, you know, business communication and video production, but I was had a spiritual practice that led me to mood and behavioral coaching, you know, kind of cleaning up my interior space and some stuff from my youth. And as a result, I saw people that could also benefit from what I was learning and doing. And so that turned into a 25-year spiritual practice, and which about 2013 or so, it occurred to me that I knew almost nothing about how the outside world really worked and knew a lot about how the inside world worked. So I felt compelled to balance that. And that led me to the law, studying exclusive equity and American history and world history, the history of law, the history of honor, as all of it leads to sacred honor. And along that path, I met Ron Gibson, and we've become dear friends, and we've worked together, and we've put on seminars and help with patent projects, and we put on live events together. He'll do a Saturday event for land patents, and I'll do a Sunday event on what I call the picture on the puzzle box, which helps people understand how this world works from a high level overview, and how everything is rooted in scriptural equity or exclusive equity, unless you move over to the public side and then you start getting into Roman civil law and statutes and codes and ordinances and executive orders and mandates and policies and all those things. And so here we are today, American Meeting Group and Ron Gibson work really well together and help people mm-hmm. to learn about things they need to consider more closely.
Awesome. And Ron, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, just a little bit about myself, I guess. I have a constitutional law background. I saw this issue of land grab and the attempted taking of our rights many years ago. And I grew up on a cattle ranch out in Southern Oregon, learned the value of land very quickly. You plow the ground, you disc it up, you put seed in it, and next spring you got a crop. Mm-hmm. And was fascinated with that. Also, I live in timber country. There were 15, 16 log trucks a day, whatever the number was, that drove up and down our little old country road at the time. And haul logs to the mills and produce lumber for people to build their homes. I also was fortunate enough to be in mining country. A lot of small miners. That's where I first learned about land patents, was from the miners. And I was just intrigued about it because I have such a love for the land anyway. But the issue of the title came up. And so I started asking more questions and digging and research. And I tell people I don't smoke, I don't chew, and I don't go with the girls that do. But I study. And I've had a lifelong habit of study. When people go into the bars, I go to the law library. And now we have an internet, the greatest law library in the world. So you know, you have to use discernment in that, because there's a lot of stuff out there that's very misleading. But all in all, I taught mining law. I'm the chairman of the largest mining district in the United States, and I've taught mining law for 27 years. I've been a lifetime of collecting information and law data that compelled me to write the book that you have, that I have also for sale. Rod has them for sale. But the issue of land is an incredible subject because, as Robert mentioned, our right of land ownership is a God-given right. And the issue of taxation is a fraud on its face, simply because how do you tax God's property? And when I tell that to people, they look at me like a deer in a headlight. And the point I'm making is there's a maximum in law that is universal, applies everywhere. Even God created that himself. One can only claim jurisdiction over that which one creates. So did the state or the county or the city or the federal government create the earth? No, they didn't. And if you go to the Bible, you will find 11 specific scriptures that address the issue that God gave us the land forever and forever, forever, forever. 11 different scriptures. And our forefathers put that phrase in every land patent that's issued by the United States. And for the purpose of that was it meant that you could have a rightful ownership of its true title. That's what a land patent is. And not only is it a land patent, it's an allodial land patent.
Right.
Allodial means owing to no one, excuse me, nor to any lord nor superior. If I can put it in simple terms, it's you're the king of your land. And that's what it was intended to be by God himself. And fortunately, our forefathers recognized and passed that on in and through the, if you, those of you who have my book, look on page 5, and I have a direct quote out of the report that went from the General Land Office to Congress and the Senate dated 1870. It says, all land patents that are issued by the government are allodial for the soil and the water. And that's another thing that's very greatly misunderstood. Water does not belong to the states. Water belongs to we, the people. And it's held in reserve for when a patent is issued, then water is part of that issuance. It isn't just the land. Okay. The water is part of that grant. Hmm. Therefore, it's already defined in law as a disposed property. So someone to come along the state and claim, you know, we're going to regulate your water, they don't have authority to do that. But the people are ignorant to the facts and the law, and so they get away with it. So then they apply for water rights and pay fees and all that other stuff that makes me want to throw up. But my goal in life has been to educate you and we, the people, if you please, of what I've been gifted by God to know and to do and have experience in that background, both in minerals and also in land titles and land ownership. And it's a fantastic subject. And I'm proud to be here with you folks today. And so that's kind of the Reader's Digest version of Ron Gibson. Anyway, I ended up writing 2 books. You're showing one of them there. The first one is What You Need to Know About Land Patents. And the second book is You're Not a Slave. And in my study of law, I determined there through research that land is not subject to taxation because it's an allodial title, it's God-given, and it belongs to we the people. And so then you get on the administrative side after the Administrative Procedures Act in 1946 that converted the Constitution to statutes and codes, common law to statutes and codes. And therefore, they ended up writing their own rules that you and I are not even subject to unless we volunteer. That's found in the City of Dallas versus Mitchell case. So anyway, I yield the floor.
Well, can I ask you on the history of this? You mentioned this the administrative procedure, the statutes and all that. My question is, are we already, if we own our land outright, is it really already ours in what you're saying so that we really shouldn't have to go through further procedure? But I mean, where are we now, and how did we get into this taxation mess of land taxation?
The taxation of land goes way back. There was a short period of time to where people volunteered to pay a tax to help the war effort. But the problem with that is that if you go back to our early history of our nation in the Revolutionary War, it wasn't the Revolutionary War didn't start because of tax on tea. That was only the straw that broke the camel's back. The big rub was land tax. Okay. And people rebelled. They said, we're not paying tax on it because we own it and it's a gift of God. That's what the word allodial means, God-given. And therefore, those people understood that. And they said, we're going to fire a shot that ended up, so to speak, going around the world. And that's what started the Revolutionary War. But in the course of that, because people did not understand that they weren't obligated, there are too many gullible people that will do anything and everything that the government tells them to do. And so that got momentum and more momentum and more momentum. But let me back up a little bit, kind of to answer your question, if I may. When the land issue came into existence by virtue of a federal enactment called the General Land Office, that was enacted in 1812. And in that enactment, Congress gave the General Land Office broad and total discretion about how, when, where, why, how much, all the attributes relative to a patent was given to them in that authority of Congress. And so everything that is required of that. By the same token, when the General Land Office issued a land patent to the private individual or individuals, then in essence, that was in stone, if I can put it in that context. And so as they went to the county to get those recorded for the purpose of protecting their property, that's why the recordation came into being. It was for the purpose of protecting the landowner. It was not for the benefit of the county or the state, pardon me, or the federal government. So what happened is that went along fine until the Administrative Procedure Act was enacted unlawfully. There's no constitutional provision for it.
That was actually one of my first episodes talking about that, the Administrative Procedure Act. It became like the fourth branch of government, the bureaucratic branch.
That was 1946, you said?
Mm-hmm.
June 11th, 1946.
Yeah.
But the total purpose, listen carefully, the total purpose of that was for the purpose of establishing a criminal syndicate. Mm-hmm. The government part, the corporate government, was the front. Are you with me here?
Yep. Yeah.
Now, they could write their own rules. That's what they did in the statutes and codes. Statutes and codes are not law. They cannot be law. They cannot even become law. They are simply corporate rules and regulations. Right. Therefore, you and I are not subject to those rules and regulations unless we volunteer to be subject to those rules and regulations. And you find that in the case called City of Dallas versus Mitchell, and the court got it right. We are not subject to government rules and regulations. Our rights come from our Creator, and we're not subject to those rules and regulations unless we volunteer to be subject to them. So, you know, this issue with volunteer, we've been tricked into that. Robert covers that subject extremely well. You know, instead of us being free, we have been bondaged ourselves through complacency, if you please. And, Jesus was critical in his day by all perspective because it came in with something so totally different. And in essence, that's kind of what this group here and others are doing. We're looked at like we're freaks.
I know.
But it doesn't change the truth. And that's the thing. The Bible says you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And I love that. And that's been my logo, if you please, my trying to think of what they call it. But anyway,
motto?
Yeah, my motto is know the truth, because the land was to set the individual free. It comes clear back in Scripture. And so the very fact of being a landowner, see, in the early days of our country, there were no such thing as voters. They were electors. And the electors were the only ones that could, quote, vote or voice their pleasure or displeasure, because they had the most to lose. Now you have people who are not landowners that are trying to control and do control a great deal of the people who own land. And so they just got it backwards. But that was the intent of the Administrative Procedures Act, was to turn everything 180 degrees. Now, let me tell you what happened after the Administrative Procedures Act was enacted, June 11, 1946. They gave them 7 years from that point of which to initiate, number one, the conversion to state corporations. Therefore, they relinquished the sovereignty of every state, at that time 48 states, and made them territorial corporations. The second thing that they did is they redefined lawful terms to make them legal terms. And the first thing that they changed, they redefined land to real estate. And then by maximum of law, they claimed jurisdiction over it. And they went right down the line. They did that all within a 7-year period of time. So then Oregon, where I live, was the last state to come on board. And then they implemented January 1, 1954, to totally administrative procedures and all that's related to that. And I'm telling you, it's a criminal syndicate. We're just seeing the manifestation of that today. But it's always ugly, right from hell. So here we are now having to deal with it. But now let me say one other thing, and I'll yield the floor here. From the time that that enactment came in, the next person that received a land patent from the General Land Office, when he went in to get that recorded, the recorder's office took that land patent and put it in a drawer. I'm just illustrating the process here, and issued back what is called now a warranty deed.
Ah. So
they were told, and the landowner said, "Where's my title?" Well, this is your new title. That's what it's the same thing. They lied to them. They betrayed them. They stole their title to their land. That's why you can go into any recorder's office, and if you have the name and the number of the land patent, they can look that up in their archive records. Now, that brings up a compelling question. How did they get those in their record and hold it? And they will give you a certified copy back out. But nobody.
Say that again. If you go into the recorder's office, they can look up, what is it?
The copy of the original land patent.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. That's why they kept those land patents and then reissued back to the landowner a warranty deed. A warranty deed is not a title. In law, it's called a color of title. So therefore, everybody didn't realize that they no longer owned their land, and they were subject to all of these statutes and codes and rules and regulations and land restriction and setbacks and environmental restriction, ta-da-da-da-da-da. And that's where we are today. Now there is a tremendous push to take everyone's land. It's not if, it's when.
Right.
And I talked to three people this morning facing the same thing. Every year since 2008, when Obama took office, there have been over 1 million foreclosures a year.
That's so how crazy. Many years?
Well, we better get it stopped.
Yeah.
And we get the taxation stopped. I have people call me almost daily. Ron, they're foreclosing on my property. I can't pay my electric bill. I can't buy my medication that I need. I can't buy gas. And yet they're coming after my property. I'm on a fixed income. I'm 87 years old. They don't care, folks. We better wake up.
Yeah.
They care less. And I want to tell you one other thing, and then I'll shut up here. If you go back and do the start of the Obama administration, when you do all of you remember the term when they helped the banks out, there's a term for
eminent
that.
Domain
the bailout.
Eminent domain.
Yeah,
the
when
bailout.
There was the
bailout.
Yeah, it's a bailout, but there's a name for it. But anyway,
eminent domain.
No.
This was it was Lehman Brothers, and then it was they didn't bail out Lehman Brothers; they let them collapse. But it was AI. Well,
what they did, if you read that, and that's about almost 3,000 pages thick, stimulus package. That's what I'm looking for.
Oh, the stimulus package. Yeah.
Yeah.
When they voted in to give all this bailout to the banks never needed the bailout simply because they took the title, which was your signature at that point, on your
Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. Yeah.
And in that, but if you're getting off the subject here, but in that you will see that there's a provision for the banks, if they were to foreclose as a stimulus package to them, they would receive of your tax dollars 80% of the original amount of the purchase of that property. Hell, there was no damn reason that they wouldn't foreclose. But Congress said that you had to give the homeowner a minimum of 20 days of which to do a loan modification. They never intended to do a loan. I only know of two since 2008 that ever got done. They did that as a front so that they would eat up the 120-day period, and then they foreclosed anyway. They foreclosed on people that had their land and property already paid for. Never had they were cash transactions or paid off. And they went and foreclosed on them anyway. And that's the kind of criminal activity that's gone on in this whole movie. So anyway.
What was the basis for foreclosure of somebody that was already paid off? Is it taxes or what would they fail to do?
The ball was rolling so big and heavy and such a steep hill that if you owned a home, then we're going to foreclose on you. They didn't care.
They just did it.
You have to
understand. They wanted the land, they just foreclosed.
They just did it because they had the power to do it.
Okay.
That's government. There's a scripture in my Bible that says it best. Never was a lion so vicious as an ungodly man with power.
Yeah.
And so that's the manifestation of what we've had to deal with all of these years. And it's increasing all the time. So anyway, that's what we're at. The land patent is the only protective document there is in our nation of laws. That's why I have pushed so hard. And when I met Robert, we hit it off and had a lot in common. Mm-hmm. And he brought a lot to the table. You know, I'm only one person.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've sold books all over the world. I sold books in Australia. I sold them in Germany. I sold them in Belgium, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, you know. So.
Well, I got your book from Americans in Action, and I love Jason Ian discussing the fact that we're like living in Babylon, and this is how we have to step out of living in Babylon. That's the way I see it, as if that's fake. Right. The whole legal system is fake, but we accept it somehow. So,
yeah. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Like, how do people extricate themselves, and how do they even begin that sort of process? I guess you can talk about it from the overarching structure, or like the premise itself, or you can talk about the land pact directly, whatever.
That's the very reason why Robert and I do these land patent seminars, trying to get people from all over the country. We do it different. We'll go to wherever that they will gather enough people to warrant to go, and we pay our own way, you know. But people just seem to sit back in complacency when the sickness was going around here a couple of years ago, whatever. Boy, people were flocking to us to learn more about it. Now that that's died down, the people wanting to protect their land has died down. In fact, it's just increased from the opposition who want more and more of which to take your land because of the complacency of the people at large.
Well, I got to say, I don't think it's totally complacency.
I don't either.
The problem is that after COVID, you know, people were sitting home and their businesses were shut down. But now people are scrambling to make up for that, you know, exactly. That debt that they incurred. That's what they do. They keep us so busy that we don't have time to do what we know we need to do. I've had that book sitting on my, you know, having read it, I've had it sitting there saying, okay, I got to find the deeds. It took me 6 months to get all the deeds together, these warranty deeds, some of which say titles, by the way, because they're old. I don't know what that means here. And now I'm in the point of actually going down to the recorder's office or doing the next step. So, it takes a while when you're out here trying to maintain an income. And that's what I think people are. I give people a little bit of the credit here because I think there are a lot of people. I hear people talking about interest in land patents all over the place, at least in Iowa, because they know we know they're coming after us.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't know. I mean, a lot of people are just starting to hear. They first hear when we did the show and we mentioned land patents. And I saw there were so many comments. I got so many emails. I've never heard of that. What is that? We want information on it. So it's been, I believe, intentionally withheld this information. So a lot of people are unaware. And then once they become aware, they feel a little bit overwhelmed because, as Dr. Lee said, you know, they're so busy trying to put food on the table, take care of their families, scrambling to make up for the past few years where we've been suppressed. And, we're intentionally kept on a rat race. And I think that is so that we don't, ascertain this type of information. And then to be able to, we're so far behind, we're so entrenched in this, false system that to then start to unravel that, it can be really daunting for a lot of people.
And I just, we've talked about on this show briefly, we've talked about homeowners association nonsense. And it strikes me that what you're saying, even without going through all the land patent thing, could undo what they're trying to do. You know, your grass can only be 11 and a half inches high. You can't have chickens. That's a big fight.
I could be wrong. I'll turn it to them too, but I think it would be a little bit different because then you enter an agreement with the homeowners association. That's one layer above.
You should be able to get out of agreements. The all contracts have a termination. You know, that's what my tax attorney taught me a long time ago, and I still believed in all that. He said the most important thing in a contract is how you get out of the contract. Contract is illicit. That makes it null and void, I would think.
That homeowners association is probably one of the worst things that a person can sign up.
I agree.
Because you're in bondage.
Yep.
And I encourage people. A lot of people ask me if they can do a land patent on a homeowners association agreement. I said, you got to get out of the agreement.
Yep.
Well, how do I do that? So I explained to him how to do that. And then, I didn't know that. So, here we are.
I can't, since I'm not in a homeowners association, maybe I skimmed over it, but is that in your book, How to Get Out of a Homeowners Agreement?
No, I didn't put that in it.
Do you want to talk about that? Because that is that's a first step for a lot of people. And it's a big step. It's a big thing that's happening.
And homeowners, I mean, they are so, like the rules, half of them are arbitrary. They're filled with petty martinets who, they think they've got a little bit of power and they want to control your entire life. They can make your life miserable. I know people firsthand, who have really, they've lost so much money trying to appease these HOAs.
That's a great picture. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, they're constantly raising their prices too, like just randomly. It's a very tough situation for a lot of people. So that would be great for people to understand that they could get out of it. A lot of people don't think they can.
Well, first of all, you have to understand contracts. And the signing of any particular document that constitutes or is represented or accepted as a contract is the binding factor. So if your signature binds it, withdrawing your signature unbinds that. So you need to do what's called a revocation of signature for cause. You need to put the for cause in there, simply because now that gives you lawful standing for withdrawing that signature and the obligation that goes along with that. So, you know, it's relatively simple. It's simple to sign up. It's equally simple. Now, they don't like it. I'm going to guarantee you they're going to squeal like a pig under a gate. And, you have to separate yourself from these. And Robert covers a lot of subjects having to do with, equity and God's law and whatever. And we bind ourselves into bondage every day and have been doing it for years and years and years. And so until we wake up to that fact and want to be free, there's two parts to freedom. Number one is the fact of realizing what freedom is. And number two is that you have to maintain to protect that freedom. And we have a lot of people who want freedom. They want liberty, but they will do nothing to protect it. And which is tragic. Yeah. I think it's absolutely tragic.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between freedom and liberty? Jason Eden talked a little bit about it. Do you have thoughts on that? Either of you?
Well, I think liberty, at least in my studies, has been that which you are willing to defend with until your death, if it need be, of something that you hold dear. Freedom can be partial, if you hear what I'm saying. You might be free of a driver's license. You might be free, whatever. Now, you're talking about total freedom. Now, that's a whole different category. So words have meanings, and we need to be sure that we do the proper term. And it's like the driver's license, not to get off the subject of your question. But unless you're in commerce, in other words, getting paid to drive, you're not obligated to have a driver's license. And in spite of what the state will tell you and the county sheriff and the police department, but if people are interested in that subject, go to Title 49 USC and read about the federal transportation rules and regulations. And you'll find that it spells it out. You're not obligated unless you are getting paid to haul or transport or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the same thing here. But liberty is, and freedom are certainly not free. It comes at great price.
Mm-hmm.
And in my seminars, I read the cost of liberty. And it's about our forefathers and the price they paid for signing the Declaration of Independence. And they paid for it dearly. Many of them with their lives, lost their family, lost their property, lost their homes. Boy, it's heart-wrenching. And to see people now who won't defend our flag, you know, the men and women who paid the price to secure that, and we're letting it slip away. You know, I read saw a thing this morning about a high school kid back in, I think he was in Iowa or somewhere back in the Midwest, had a U.S. flag stuck in one of the pockets of his pickup bed. And the school... the principal told him, you take that off or we're going to expel you from school. That young man stood up and said, I'm not taking my flag down. And so anyway, the video went viral and they came back with so much horse shit that, oh, gee whiz, we agree with him and the flag is so important or whatever. Well, if it's important, then how come it wasn't important when he's driving around with a flag on his pickup bed?
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, but anyway, liberty, if you look at it in its true sense, is that you're willing to sacrifice your life to protect or defend. That's what our forefathers did. That's what our men and women in uniform have done throughout our nation's history. I'm a former Marine. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I've seen a lot of death in my life. And I'm telling you, military people put their life on the line to protect and defend people they will never meet or ever know. Now, I'm telling you, that's commendable. Mm-hmm. And I salute all of them for that very thing.
But hold on. I thought there were no former Marines. I was a Navy doctor. We took care of you guys. That was the patois. There's no such thing as a former Marine.
That's true. I will correct that and say I'm a Marine.
Yeah, there you go.
And I'm proud of it. I wasn't drafted. I volunteered. My own family said, are you nuts? You're going to go to Vietnam and end up dead. I said, it may be. But you know what? My uncle was in Korea. My grandfather was in World War II. My great-grandfather was in World War I. And our lineage goes clear back. I have an obligation to carry that liberty forward no matter what it takes. And I'm willing to sacrifice whatever it takes to accomplish that goal. So,
What's the you mentioned that we're talking about the spiritual aspect here too, and the honor. How does that play in here? If we can get
well, God has a rightful place. Too bad too many people don't put Him in His rightful place or allow Him to be in his rightful place. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, there's no saying you'll never find an atheist in a foxhole. And my point of it is that God has laid out a perfect plan for our life in this nation. This nation has been blessed unbelievably beyond our ever wildest dream. But now we've got complacent and, you know, there's an element that Rod uses and I use both, but there's an element called honor. You know, we used to honor God, and then the secular section of our society said, well, we don't need God anymore. We can work this out ourselves. We used to honor our government, but our government was never been honorable. Right. So when we woke up to that fact, we used to honor the family. You know, women were honored. I remember the pilots and stuff that I was around there in Vietnam would paint the name of their wife or their girlfriend on the side. It was a way of honoring them. And we used to honor our children. Now we sexually abuse them.
Right. Well, I was basically wondering if Robert could talk about how this plays, how we can practically use these concepts to extract us from the Babylonian or Roman system that we're in.
Exactly.
You want to jump in here, Robert?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, there's a spectrum. Like you could take a line and on one end of it, put 100% publicly dependent and then go across the line to the other side and be 100% privately independent. And there's a lot of different ideas and concepts about the differences between those points and how they interact. First of all, they are separate kingdoms. So scripturally, it was said that give unto God that which is God's and give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. So clearly there's some line in the sand that is crisp and clear. And how do we focus well enough to see that line sharp and clear when we're 100% dependent and we just want to say a few things or believe a few things and think that the public record or our relation to the public record entirely shifts? You know, since we were born, a narrative has been being...
Oops, we just lost you.
You back?
Where are our instruments? Oh, I'm sorry.
We'll have to have you say that again. We didn't hear that.
Yes, we lost you.
Where did it end?
You got past Caesar and God, and we were about ready to you say a few things, and that's not enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. We have a relation on the public record that began at birth. And they have been creating a narrative and keeping the records of that narrative. So facts are put on the public record and they are interpreting them to be your consent, your voluntary consent for, there's a doctrine called parens patriae, which is the state is the parent, because we are what they call human creatures, which are animals under the animal kingdom. And so under the laws of nature, under the law of the jungle, its inherent condition is trespass and harm and dishonor. It's just wild nature. And so back to the freedom and liberty part, that's freedom, where you're free to do anything. Mm-hmm. It's a wild, wild world.
Right.
And so you're free to do all the shadow side stuff, the dark side, until you bring a higher law form. So something above the law of the jungle or the laws of nature. And that's the laws of nature's God. And so some people have trouble with God. There's been a lot of effort to try to make you feel that it's just comfort food for the weak. But the contemplation of God and the contemplation of honor has gone on for, I believe, since the caveman times, when they started to notice the environment around them and wondered what their place was in it and why they could contemplate these things. Why did they have this extra consciousness? Why did they have this extra awareness? And so over thousands and thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, probably more, this competency hierarchy emerged and was in competition with a dominance hierarchy, which is survival of the fittest and law of the jungle, self-interest stuff, where these types of abuses or unjust enrichments were acceptable because it was freedom, total freedom. And our animal nature organizes us in a dominance hierarchy. So we rose above that because of a capacity we were given for what scripture refers to as spiritual discernment, or what exclusive equity refers to as the eyes of equity. So what's the difference between uncorrupted scripture or scriptural equity and exclusive equity? Is that exclusive equity is expressed in a non-religious context. And that's how you can create a private society, like a Republican form of government per se, and you can pledge your sacred honor to each other, but you don't settle disputes with one religious doctrine preferred over another, especially because we had a Judeo-Christian, a primary Judeo-Christian foundation. And so which one of those was going to be the one that you settle controversies with, because there were subtle differences. And so exclusive equity was a way to say, look, we're going to express and maintain the most honorable methods of settling disputes and interacting with each other so that something can be true for everybody. And what is the truth other than something that's true for everybody? If it's not, then it's a relative truth. It's a partial truth, and that invites controversy. So there's a pathway to going from 100% publicly dependent to 100% privately independent. And it includes things like knowledge, for one. That's very important. You can't be ignorant of the law, of the truth. You have to become more deeply and deeply aware, and then you have to own it. It becomes a lifestyle, not a weekend seminar or a book. And I believe we really need to be raised into the truth for it to be the most deeply embodied. And so when we're interfered with by a public agenda like global dominance and international commerce and moving everybody from the private into the public, being 100% publicly dependent all across the planet, their job becomes blurring that line. And they've been at it for thousands of years, and they're very effective. And one of the things that they do that's so effective is take objective and simple definitions of words and create a myriad of confusion around them. And nowadays we see that they're making them subjective definitions. And so something like liberty could mean a weekend's pass, right, out of the military, off the ship or something like that. And so freedom is total freedom. Liberty, in the context that Ron is describing it, is freedom plus morality, or freedom plus exclusive equity, or freedom plus the laws of nature's God. So these are aspirations that we need to be encouraged to rise to, because that's where our authority comes from as stewards of this place. To take care of the land or to take care of each other requires authority. And if we abandon that authority, knowingly or unknowingly, it's still abandoned. So if you have rights and interests in that authority, but you leave evidence that you want somebody else to have it, you've granted it to somebody else, that's what we do on the public record, that's a problem, because you have abandoned the property to somebody else, and now you can't just stand up and claim it's your property, because they have evidence that your choice, it's only one signature on your applications and on your licenses and when you register property and all of that. You don't sit down with somebody and you both sign. If anything, you know, they have a notary, but that's just to assure that it was you that volunteered your mark, your consent. And so there is a pathway. A lot of people commingle it and confuse it and don't cross the line all the way. It's a long journey to restore your sacred honor on the public record. And it requires what in the story of Christ, he said, leave it all and follow me. Let it go and follow me. And so there's a process of disconnecting your duties and obligations to that public system. And it's scary for people. And part of keeping us busy all the time is making us feel like we've made a large investment into the titles that we rely upon, the publicly created and publicly administered titles, the ones that we apply for and license for or register property for. And like Ron said, those are all color of title. They're shadow titles. They're they're characteristic titles as opposed to titles by nature, which we create ourselves under the authority that we were granted at birth and intended for us throughout our lifetime to use our talents and our gifts to create communities or private societies. They call them private because of the relationship to the public, but societies, villages, whatever you want to call them, to do the mighty work honorably, right? To make this place a better, more prosperous place with all of the infinite resources that have been granted to our dominion and disposal. And so that's a little bit about liberty and freedom and how people move from 100% publicly dependent to 100% privately independent. And if you'd like to hear more about the independent side, I'd be glad to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I have some of this. I did my repudiation of my corporate citizenship, and that felt good. It's been a really interesting experience to do that, and then to realize the fraud all around me. It could just kind of wake it. I think that's a step everybody should take. Are you kind of in that? You know, the idea of repudiation, because when I look around now, I realize everything's been corporatized. Mm-hmm. You know, our little town incorporated 1871, interesting date. It's always incorporated. And but the problem we get into is, even if you've done that and you recognize the fraud, all your public officials that are around you don't recognize the fraud. So when it comes to saving our land, it's going to be a slug, I suspect. But what's your thoughts?
So this is one of the first steps that people bump into when moving from 100% publicly dependent to 100% privately independent, is that, oh, there is a declaration or a repudiation or something that I can do that fixes it all. And so if you start out 100% publicly dependent, you're in a Roman civil system. And so when in Rome, you have to do as Romans do. And for legal effect, you require legal ease. Yeah. And so if you're going to use a word like repudiate or cancel or terminate or revoke or any of those types of things, it would do you well to go to those dictionaries and read those definitions. But because they did offer us an equitable exit, but it's a pinhole. And it requires spiritual discernment in order to understand it and have the faith in it that's required, but it's there. And most of the words that people are using, if you read the definition, it doesn't have the legally binding effect that people hope it does. So I'm not saying a repudiation is wrong. It's a start. At least you're starting a narrative and you're putting evidence on the public record. So you can start to defend that, but because it's not legally binding, you're probably not going to have good results. But some people do get results because there's a thing called discretionary discharge of the public charges. So you have to defend it. And if you defend it well enough, the judge might say, you know what, the fruit here isn't hanging low enough. And I don't want to get tangled up in all this mess and all this stuff is on the record. And so I've heard of people getting discharges intermittently, but it's not authority, right? It's like rolling the dice. It's more like a dice roll. And since that's been going on for a few years now, the Bar Association has appeared to have responded by ignoring it or punishing it. And there's a reason for that. And that is because when they turn on their computers, you don't have the rights or interests in the standing that would compel them to provide relief. So what you get is a rule 12b6 that says failure to state a claim in which relief can be granted, because there's still a defect, an underlying or fundamental defect, and that is your pledge, your one signature cursive autograph on applications and licenses and registrations. You're checking boxes. So you're accepting all these Roman titles like employee, spouse, child, driver, voter, citizen, resident, individual, right on down the list. And so those are all titles that they created that you volunteered for and accepted to be the assurance that those titles, those debtors, would perform the public charge, whether it's fines and fees or whether it's rules, mandates, policies, statutes, codes, you know, guidelines, all that sort of thing. So they attach a charge to the debtor, which is all legal fiction. But you volunteer to make sure the debtor performs. And so they come to the volunteer to compel the performance. So that's a lot all at once, but that is the riddle that we're all trying to solve. That's how they get voluntary servitude instead of involuntary servitude.
Right, but you didn't. You did that before you wrote them and said, I'm no longer playing in your Babylonian system. I mean, doesn't that, and then, I'm just saying, a simple thing that had happened to me was I was called up to jury duty, and when I simply asked them to explain how to fill out the form, because they're asking me to act for this entity, asking me if it's dead. Well, how can an entity like a corporate entity be dead? So I asked them that, and I put it on. I said, and if I don't hear from you and by this date, which was a date to go to court, then I'll assume this matter is closed. Never heard from them, but the point is that you get to a point where if you believe what you've written, that you're not that entity anymore. Didn't that entity? I mean, as long as you're consistent after you do the discharge, doesn't that matter?
It helps, but it's not legally binding, but they may make discretionary choices about what they're going to have to go through with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But they still have interest in the titles that you're using, right? You're using their debtor for a bank account. You're using their debtor for utilities. You're using their debtor for a mortgage. You're using their debtor as an employee, etc. And so those are all legal terms. They created them. It's part of their proprietary commercial language. And it's part of a Roman administrative system, like Rome in their testamentary trust, Unum Sanctum. The Pope said when he was creating the public charitable trust, which is what all this is, he said, he quoted scripture, 1 Corinthians 2:15, and said, the spiritual man or woman is the judge of all things, who can be judged by no man or woman. So there's your self-governing sacred steward who rose above the law of the jungle and is not running by animal instinct, but by spiritual discernment or the eyes of equity. So they don't need any governing. They're judged only by God. Or only by equity. So,
okay.
That's... But a second thing he said was, but the human creature is subject to the Roman pontiff. So that they're declaring dominion over creatures that creep at the earth, animals, animal instincts, self-preservation, survival of the fittest, self-interest, dishonor, harm. So really the system itself, and people don't like when I say this, but before this globalist corporate drifting into that, before that, the system was in sacred honor. If you read it, it has cures and remedies. At-law really was just a system for clever people to gain an advantage through your consent, through contracting, that they wouldn't otherwise have under scripture or under exclusive equity.
And that happened in the last couple hundred years. You're talking about the 1800s, right?
That was my question. When you keep talking about this Roman law, at what point are you saying that they've created the system?
Well, they've always had a global dominion effort, but it evolved. And so the modern version of it, I believe, or I interpret, started with Unum Sanctum. And I think that was like in
that
the
was
1300.
No, 1300. He just pulled it up. It was 1303, I think. Oh, okay. Even earlier. Philip levy taxes on the French clergy. February 1296, Boniface responded with the papal bull, Clarices Lacios, I don't know how to say that, that forbade clerics without authority from the Holy See to pay taxes to temporal ruler and threatened excommunication on rulers who demanded such payments. That was in 1296. But then I think it was 1302. Yeah, okay. Pope Boniface VIII on 18th of November 1302 laid out dogmatic propositions on the unity of the Catholic Church, the necessity of belonging to it for eternal salvation, the position of the Pope as supreme head of the Church, and the duty thence arising to submission to the Pope in order to belong to the Church and thus attain salvation. The Pope further emphasized the higher position of the spiritual in comparison with the secular order. The historian Brian Tierney calls it probably the most famous document on church and state in medieval Europe. The original document is lost, but a version of the text can be found in the registrars of Boniface VIII in the Vatican archives. The bull was the definitive statement of the late medieval theory of hierarchy, which argued for the temporal as well as spiritual supremacy of the Pope. That's very interesting, the hierarchy, because that's actually what Adam Weishaupt, he was a student of the Jesuits at Ingolstadt, and he actually modeled the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, which was initially, which was called back then the Perfectibilis, but he modeled it after the Jesuit structure. He said that that's where he got the hierarchy model from. Interesting.
But I would hate to think that we are as little people that don't have, you know, we're not the Pope and we don't have the papal library. I hate to think that there's not a solution to us regaining our freedom here. I mean, there is a practical solution here. I don't want to leave our listeners thinking it's all doom and gloom. What can you say that's not doom and gloom? Hopefully, you have something that's not doom and gloom.
No, because in that papal bull, what you read is what they're willing to put out into the public.
Right. I know. Once they said Vatican archives, I was like, yeah, the Vatican archives are their archives that are locked, and most of it we never see. Yeah. We have no access to.
Did you use the word lost? That the papal bull was lost, but print is available? Or did you say locked?
Locked. Yeah, like they're lost. Oh, I think they're locked. Like they don't allow us to see it. The archives are locked.
I thought they said at one point something was lost. Yeah.
The original document was lost. Oh, that's what you're. I didn't know which one you were referring to. Okay.
In their minds, at least, we don't know that's true.
No, and they are, you know, the world's expert record keepers, and this is the trust indenture. Mm-hmm. So I find it hard to believe that it was lost.
Yeah,
but
I do too.
Anyways, nonetheless, so people are not good at sacred honor. They have the capacity to be good at it. Almost all of us, virtually all of us, have the capacity. It's one of our sacred gifts. It's why Scripture says we've been granted dominion, but we're not good at developing the ability because we like fast, easy, cheap. And that's what they sell us in exchange for their administration. So there's no doom and gloom for making the journey from being publicly dependent to privately independent. It really is. Your IQ increases, your joy, which is a stable state, increases, your authority increases, the community of people improves. We start to work together. We create private societies like PMAs or private ministries. We interact with private unincorporated trusts or private unincorporated business trusts that are expressed through exclusive equity. And we grow, but we have to do something about that public record. And so I'm usually reluctant to go into that too fast because people can hurt themselves, and I don't want to be the source of harm and suffering, because it's a destructive process to the titles that you are currently depending on. So you have to take a series of steps. And what the first is education or learning, like we talked about earlier. And then the second is constructing a private estate and building the titles underneath that estate. And that private estate comes from your inherent rights after you accept the sacred trust that God or creation expressed and implied that we're supposed to be taking care of it. So there's your sacred duties. So you create an estate, you create the title so that other people can know who you are, and you can protect the work you're doing on behalf of perfection or heaven on earth. And none of that has anything to do with a Roman public charitable trust for human creatures. It can. Charity is a big part of helping out, but that's not where we got yet so far. We're just creating an infrastructure so that property that we're an authorized representative over in the public can be disposed of on behalf of the debtor out into the private. And so that is a way that you can start to have your private life become more and more sustainable. And if you can create a private trade where you're exchanging sacred substances privately, and sacred substances are things like gold and silver, but they're also things like thank you and you're welcome, right? That's all equitable material. You get a beneficial use of it by nature. So earlier I mentioned equitable title by nature is when you recover that, you have authority over it, because it was the will of creation, or it was the will of God. And we have the gifts that support that. The capacity for spiritual discernment, if we develop it, and the capacity for the eyes of equity. There are two different languages intended to do the same thing. So in my classes, I just try to teach people that if you're not ready for scripture, uncorrupted scripture yet, then learn exclusive equity, and that'll be a bridge, because you'll find out where all the authority comes from. Right? It was here before we were. It's here right now between us on this podcast, and it'll be here long after all of us are gone or all the books are burned about it. It's a truth. It's a permanency. So you keep taking these steps, and if you can make your private lifestyle work without hurting your public lifestyle, you're well underway. Like, you're halfway there. And then you'll still be subject to public controversies because you are relying upon these public titles. And so maybe you can, I'll give you the word that's important. The word is rescission. And when you go look at that definition, it says extinguishes all duties and obligations as if it never occurred in the first place, and not a mere termination. So to me, that sounds like forgiveness. That's forgiveness. But I'm a volunteer, so how can equity aid the volunteer? Well, it says it includes an equitable right for impossibility, fraud, or mutual mistake. So I spent a year trying to solve that riddle, the equitable riddle, around those three conditions to get that extinguishment as if it never occurred in the first place and not a mere termination. And so I thought, well, if they're giving me forgiveness or offering me forgiveness, how am I going to balance the equities? That's really what equity is about. It's rooted in equal. And it doesn't mean you get 10 and I get 10, but we get our equal rights and interests, our righteous rights and interests in a controversy. So if I take responsibility for my ignorance of the law, then I made a mistake that caused them to make a mistake. And now I have to figure out what that is. And like I said, I spent quite a while on it, well over a year. And, you know, impossibility is obvious. If you and I make an arrangement that's impossible to complete, why should we argue over it? Why should we build resentment and hostility, maybe turn to violence or even war, when equity can come in and say, hey, this is impossible. You guys are silly for creating such an arrangement. This is extinguished as if it never occurred in the first place and not just a mere termination. Then you have fraud. And a lot of people like that one because it appeals to the idea of being victimized. And so you want justice. And that's good. Am I saying it's not fraud? Not really. I'm sure there are people that convey it fraudulently. Your duties and obligations are that you have to sign this or you have to do this, that there are no other choices but this. Did they do it with criminal intent? That's a little trickier equation to solve. And if you're bringing fraud as a charge, then we all know he who brings the charge carries the burden of proof. But if we have waived or abandoned all our rights and interests in lawful standing, right, honorable, exclusive equity, scripture, righteous, and that's all on the public record, that's a defect, that's going to be something we have to overcome. And how would we used to overcome that? We would at least have courts of honor, courts of common law and exclusive equity. We would have lawful money, coin, silver and gold coin or barter. We would have our own private titles, our estates, and our private ministries or our private member associations or our trading companies. And we would have all of this lawful standing to enforce the honor in the peace treaties and the constitutions. Our equitable peacekeepers, like constitutional sheriffs, but that was all a method of maintaining and enforcing the honor. But when we waived all that or abandoned all that, now we're in a international commercial system.
Yeah.
And it's their private club. It's all their titles. It's all their property. And we have just volunteered to be the assurance for the performance of their debtors, their titles, their legal person fictions. And so we have to take these steps. But since we're 100% dependent, we better be really careful using destructive technology to leave Rome with honor. It's not for everybody. And so for those who it's not for, doesn't mean you can't make yourself right with God. You can do that privately, but the public record still is a function that is so pervasive, so everywhere, that, you know, we have a duty and an obligation to cleanse the public record to the extent that we can.
And where would you start? Let me just ask a practical question. Where would you start?
Well, registration for the draft might be a place.
Okay. Don't have to do that because I'm female. Give me the next one.
Right.
Driver license.
Okay. And how, you know, I mean, I'm supposed to I don't want to get in a fight with the police, obviously, but the policy enforcer on the side of the road. But I'm in the process of having to re-register my car. It costs quite a bit of money to do that. And I thought I would write to the, you know, somebody. I mean, I can do it to my local treasurer, but that probably wouldn't get me any far. But to the state and say, please provide the evidence that I need to do this because I do not perform commercial transportation. And But but what do you actually do? I mean, how if you think that's the most important thing to start with, I wouldn't have picked that one. But if that's it, what?
No,
what
do I just tried to find one that might be common and
right. That
simple.
Is a common one.
Yeah. Again, these are very sensitive matters because people can hurt themselves.
Right, but is there a common way to approach it? I mean, in other words, yes. When I look like your banking thing, I could see going to the banker and saying, could I see my contract from my, I still want to do banking, but could I see the contract from my banking signature form and just change it? I mean, I think I can probably do that. I just don't know where
open
to turn.
And
to, if we're going to save America and step out of this system, we have to have some ways of doing it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. So the public is Roman property. And to approach the public openly is not private. It's combative. So they see it that way. They see it as a disturbance of the peace. They see it as a foreign invasion. And so,
okay. So how do we do
this? Well, I think we're at the grassroots level of creating communities, private communities, where you invite people to your events and you should get them to join as a member, and you encourage word of mouth, and it starts to spread, and you start to build numbers of people who want to meet together privately and do private things and learn about private things. And I know the urge is to jump out there and to get it as far and wide and as fast as possible and give everybody the depths of the riddle, but they're not ready for it.
Oh, I get that. I'm asking about me. I'm just trying to think, if I can't do it, who can do it? And I, for example, I'm not practicing medicine. I don't care if I have a medical license anymore, but I'm doing a private meeting. I give medical advice. I talk about, you know, not personal medical advice, but I give medical information. People want to reward me monetarily for that. It's a subscription private club, essentially. But what next? I mean, what?
Yeah.
But you see, I'm still in the banking system. So. That's my point, is I don't see how to actually act on what you're saying. I get it, but. And maybe you're saying I'm just way ahead of this and I need to go back to step one, in which case I'm really willing to do it. I just don't see what step one is.
Right. Yeah, I think we lost him. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? I
totally get what you're saying. And
I want to save my land and I don't have infinite time.
Right. And he's talking about creating essentially private worlds that are, you know, I think the best way to think of it is like he's talking about creating parallel systems, which makes sense. You can't just.
No, and that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, exactly. But I think people need to have a sense. I mean, not just for the audience, but, you know, like you specifically, me specifically, we need like actionable items, how we start with the. I also am just very curious because he keeps, I know we tried to find it with the 1302. Date, but I am very curious when you keep calling this the, I don't know if you can speak to this. I'll text him also, but maybe Ron, you can speak to this. It's just,
serious.
So, yeah, we lost you. But I'll finish this and then we'll go back. We'll back up a minute. But what I'm curious about is when you call it this Roman law system, and you're saying that we're in the Roman law, I'm still not clear on what that means or where that comes from. And I know you say that that's been, you know, always been there, this desire to have an internationalist system. And I get that. I mean, I've studied enough history to see that that's true. And that just seems to be the warring factions between man. If you know, see this as a spiritual battle, you know, those who want to control and enslave the free will of humanity here on earth, and those who believe that there is some sort of a divine creation and there is an eternal presence and that it's, you know, greater than the here and now. And so they therefore they believe that there is a free will that's endowed to the humans who are here. And that just seems to be, I mean, now I see it that way, that's the battle. But I still, in terms of the codification of this term, Roman law, like where does that begin? How is it Roman law that we are subscribing to?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah, if you can, either one of you, if you want to answer that, yeah, or both of you can.
Versus, like, when you cite USC code, blah 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 blah, is that just Roman law brought into modern times? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, if you go to the governing buildings around the country, do you see patriots with triangle hats, or do you see Roman lore?
Right. No, I know what you're saying. I get that.
So, but human rights. Right, the human creature is subject to the Roman pontiff. Civil rights, Roman civil society, Roman civil law.
But I just hope that we have a way of getting out of it. That's what
I hope so too. But I do also, I think if we can clarify, really, like, so which Rome? I mean, like, when are we talking about? When was this instantiated? Because I think that actually, if you can understand a root cause of something, I think naturally you can appreciate this. Like, if you understand the root cause of you know, your symptoms, you have a better chance of being able to alleviate them rather than putting a Band-Aid on it.
Jason Ian talks about Babylonian law, and look around the world. I mean, look around our country. He's right. All these buildings, they're showing pictures of, I mean, people in togas and, you know, Babylonian gods, essentially. We have all these weird symbols all over our country. So maybe the revolution was maybe not what we thought it was. In other words, we just didn't get out of all that, even though we had a breather, maybe.
Well, the end of the revolutionary conflict was a settlement.
Yeah.
Right. Not a conquest.
Right.
Right.
So that means that the crown of England got something, and the Vatican got something, and the people who no longer wanted to be subject to those societies got something. That's why they said, well, we've given you a republic if you can keep it. That meant due diligence. And we got led astray by semantic deceit. And in commerce, anybody can make anybody an offer as long as it's not to harm somebody. So what they are doing are making offers, and we get to choose to accept them or not. Now, not everybody understands that because of the line in the sand being so blurry and confusing. So some of the lower agents get pretty coercive about the offers, but we lose track of when we pledge.
That's a nice way to put it. that's the policeman saying you will sign this speeding ticket. Yeah, I get you.
Yeah.
The nicest way I've seen that put, though. They get pretty coercive.
That's how equity would look at it, because they're looking at a forensic examination of the chain of title and what rights and interests belong to who in a property or in a controversy over a property. And so when we get out of the subjectivities and the belief systems and are able to see more clearly, then the situation at hand becomes more clear. And, you know, I enjoy talking about this stuff, but in order to really make sense of it, it takes some work. Like, it takes some study time, or at least some exposure time, because all these little seeds get planted. Like today, between Ron and I don't know how many new concepts have been introduced to your audience, but they're not able to connect them all. But they're probably resonating at some level, or beginning to resonate. Some were just too far out of reach, and so it might sound like it's too overwhelming, or I'll never get it, or what is he even talking about? Like your question about Rome. Like, Rome is not only a location, it's an idea.
Right, I know. That's why I'm asking. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm are we talking about, like, the origins of the Roman Empire, or are we talking about the Vatican? Like, what are we talking about when you say Roman law?
That's the great Pope.
I get it.
So we would say, what is the intent and purpose of the Roman idea? And then you can start to see the titles claim property in furtherance of the intent and purpose. So that's part of the eyes of equity. And what we see is that the Roman system has reached around the earth. Mm-hmm. And they've installed it, usually through military might. And then they get it up and running.
Well, that was the purpose of the Jesuits. They were the militaristic arm of the Vatican.
Yes. And then once they get it running, they consider it better than what was there. And then they start, you know, bringing people into it, contracting them into it. And as it got bigger and bigger and bigger, they made bolder and bolder and bolder moves. You know, like with us, in the 1930s with the New Deal and the Great Society, right. we were private. And then they created a system under emergency war powers that essentially mm-hmm. said everybody is presumed to be public.
Right.
And now that's an offer, and some people didn't accept it. Most did. They turned in their gold and silver at face value for paper, unsecured paper. Well, I guess it was secured back then. It became
back
unsecured.
Then it was. Yeah, in the 70s it became unsecured. Yeah.
And then registering birth property. And off to the races they went and had all these acceptances on the record.
Right.
Yeah.
But if it's that easy to accept it, literally by my mother signing it, it ought to be somehow, in other words,
undo it.
Unaccept it. There ought to be, even if I didn't, if I'm a 25-year-old guy who's, a laborer, and I don't have time to completely devote my life to this, isn't there a way for him to get out? Aren't there some things that he can be given to help him get mm-hmm. out of this? This is my point. Or are we as a population captured that until we reach a tipping point, which we may not have time to reach, it's over for us? We have to have some kind of collective consciousness of this, and it will all and dissolve the whole system. It seems to me those are our two choices if we're going to actually not be serfs anymore, not be slaves. I completely believe what you're saying. I completely believe we are Roman slaves. We've never not been slaves.
And it's a consortium, right? It looks like now it's a consortium, you know, between the Vatican, the City of London, and D.C.,
right. I mean, the pharaohs just took off their headdress and they became corporate CEOs. And that's what essentially the pontiff still is. But my point is okay, if we're ready to be out, can we do it as individuals, or does this have to be an entire civilizational change?
You can improve the civil status of your debtor. And there's lots of ways to do that. And there's a lot of teachers out there teaching theories about how to make that happen. And as you're successful at that, your discharges become more frequent, or your immunities improve, your privileges and immunities. However, if you're looking to restore your sacred honor on the public record and no longer be an assurance for a Roman debtor, then you have to extinguish those duties and obligations as if they've never occurred in the first place, and not just a mere termination. So that's them giving you equitable relief for impossibility, fraud, or mutual mistake. And impossibility we take off the table because what happened wasn't impossible. Fraud, you know, a lot of people like that. I say it has some merit.
And this is rescission. You're talking about this is how you...
Yes.
Okay.
But you're bringing a charge, so you have to prove it. And since we don't have courts of honor on our side of the treaties and constitutions anymore, we have to go into foreign jurisdiction and give notice of dishonor, fraud, and we have to prove it. But when they turn on the computer, they'd see you living off of them for decades, usually.
And well, not so, me. I don't feel that way. I mean, they are living off of me, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I paid them so much money and I've gotten very little in response.
I don't know if we could just pull up the term nexum. on Wikipedia, because I think this might just be interesting for people to see. I'll read it while you're looking for it, but it's Nexum was a debt bondage contract in the early Roman Republic. A debtor pledged his prison as collateral if he defaulted on his loan. Details to this contract are obscure, and some modern scholars dispute its existence, but it was allegedly abolished either in 326 or 313 BC. I just think this is interesting because this is kind of the concept that all of what you're saying is derived from. So just for people, I know this is there's a long web to untangle, and you're kind of presenting it as like a spectrum between the public and private honor. But I think that this concept might be just interesting to codify it for people.
Well, all throughout history, people have been taking a knee in front of the king and pledging their fealty, their loyalty, and their duty and service. The king didn't get down on his knee and meet you there. It wasn't a contract. It was a pledge. Mm-hmm. And so as the system evolved, and we got privileges for that, like protection, protect the realm. You get to serve the glory of the realm. You be a part of making this great realm exist and survive.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I helped win the Cold War. That was kind of funny now. I have a little ribbon.
That's nice. And so today it comes in the form of a one signature contract, pledging.
Right.
And that not only is that pledge unqualified or unrestricted, meaning beneficiary is a qualification, ambassador for Christ is a qualification, state, national, mm-hmm. whatever, people have different qualifications that they claim in the private, but it's also unrestricted, like without recourse, all rights reserved. And the problem is they get us early enough that we don't have that standing. Not everybody understands that, so you'll get ignorance discharge or discretionary discharge, but you have to cleanse that. You have to cleanse that pledge from the public record, and you have to do it honorably, and rescission is an honorable forgiveness. And I tell people, don't go out and do it. Don't do it, right? Take some time to build your learning and your private estate, get it functioning. Right, get it sustainable to the point where you can rescission some of these titles that you no longer have to rely upon. Now, how do people like Ron and I do it? In December of 23, we just got an original land patent issued to a small group of us with our names on it in small and lowercase letters. And so it's an original land patent in our private names, and there's no capitalization, there's no commerce, no capital. And it's so what it proves to the county clerks and what it proves to any bar member is that it undermines all the things they say to people coming to the county to convert their real estate to private land. And that is, they say, oh, those old things are obsolete. We haven't recognized them in decades. And the people that are engaged in that behavior are troublemakers. So that's the common trope that seems to be emerging around the country. But we just got one.
And you got it through land that had been titled otherwise?
No. This is the first disposal from the government to people.
Of disposal of what, though? Was this really about land, or was this?
Yes.
It was about what? I'm sorry.
Yes, land. It's a land patent with our.
But I mean, there's actually land that you have in common. Yes. Then you own. Okay.
Yes.
And there was no title on it before.
Well, there was a federal land patent, I believe. Ron may know better, but was granted to the state to dispose of to raise resources for public schools.
I got you. So you took some, there was state land that you converted to your land. somehow.
Yeah, it was in a land trust. It never belonged to the state. It had an intent and purpose to be held until they were ready to dispose of it to gather resources for schools. And so we participated in an auction.
Ah, I got you. Okay. And but so that shows a precedent now. So other people can say, there are land patents. You can give me mine.
Yes. Ron, if you want to comment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just go ahead.
Is that only in your state, or is this something that this precedent is now a national precedent?
Well, no, nationwide, with the exception of the colonial states. The colonial states, though, all those lands were issued by what they call crown patents. But everything excluding that is open now for disposal. And like Robert said, we just proved that. Now that anyone, because if you, to digress a little bit on that, if I may, the government told everybody in and through the Federal Land Policy Management Act, better known as FLPMA, that all of the Homestead Act had been repealed, that the mining law of 1866 had been repealed, which was a bold-faced lie. I have a copy of the document. Robert's probably got a copy of it. Our cohort Patrick's got a copy of it. And it says specifically that those enactments of Congress were not repealed. And I'll tell you why they weren't repealed, because the land patent issue under the Homestead Act of 1862 is constitutional.
Yeah.
It's found in Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. They can't repeal the mining law because that also is a congressional act that is also tied to national defense. Both of those are under Title 30. So they wanted to make sure that the United States government had access to minerals for the betterment of man and also for military hardware for national defense. So it's all tied together. They can't separate that. So the point of it is you can still go get patents either under the Homestead Act or you can go get patents under the Mineral Act. So to answer your question, that includes you and all of us here. You can go get it. And Robert just alluded to the fact that we have land patents in our name. The names are on the document.
Nice.
Yeah, that's great.
So that has provided us a lawful standing as allodial grantees. And grantees are people in undisputed, unencumbered possession of a property and including the rights and interests in the property, owing to no one.
So, undisputed and unencumbered.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a grantee. And a grantee can come as a grantor because he has undisputed possession.
Right.
And as a grantor, you can split the titles into legal and equitable, which expresses a trust, create an indenture, which is all the rules of the trust. It's the law of the trust. And then the trustees carry out their duties and obligations on behalf of the beneficiary. And then when you bring those titles back together, you extinguish the trust. And then somebody becomes a grantee of the trust property or a group of people, according to the indenture, the law of a trust. So once you get a land patent, whether you bid on school trust lands or you homestead at the public lands, you have the foundation of your private estate.
Now and you can convert your own land into a patent, though, right?
It's a much tougher job because you're bumping into these corporate fiefdoms that are heavily guarded by the Bar Association, and they're totally willing to throw the agents under the bus. Whether they know they're doing it or not, they do it. I was on a call not long ago where a lady who had studied the land patents, went to her county to put her claim on the record, and she was getting the clerk filled, her head was filled with, these are obsolete, we haven't recognized these in, you know, decades, and that these people are troublemakers. So she was just ignoring her and was annoyed by her. And so here's the intended beneficiary of the public record talking to their trustee about putting a lawful, honorable instrument onto the public record in order to keep the peace, you know, to give notice and to keep the peace, and was basically, you know, getting the the hand or getting the back. And so she went to federal court and sued her in her person. So for constitutional violations and breach of trust and duty and concealing the public record from the intended beneficiary and these sorts of things. And so she got scared and said, well, I was just following orders. And so she cross-claimed the county attorney. And when the county attorney was on the stand, he said, she came to me for a legal opinion, and so I gave her one. That's my job. But I can't be responsible for her oath to the Constitution. And so what you're seeing there is a deflection of liability, and that we are all responsible. We can't be ignorant of the law. Mm-hmm. And so they're not getting trained properly. And that's what the, you know, the zoning people, the building people, the police departments and other agencies, they're not getting the training about their oath. They think that the commercial side is the oath. And besides, they get threatened. You know, they'll lose their job, and if they don't toe the corporate line, the public line. That's so exactly ultimately, right. It's our responsibility. Our generations have not understood the law or pursued the law or held the republic. You know, we didn't keep it. We let it slide away. And it's not that it's gone. It can't ever be gone. It's permanent, right? It's the truth. But we have allowed an alternative to build up so big and so vast and so greedy for power and control. It's a dominance hierarchy. So our competence has to increase dramatically. And that's on an individual basis first. Then we find each other. Then we build community, right? And then communities start to interconnect. And so this pathway, the sacred honor pathway, is you have to get that land. Then your towns have to exchange lawful money. And we have a great provider of that. Maybe we could talk about someday. But and then you have to have your titles, and then you have to do private trade and exchange. And if you can restore your public honor to the public record, then I believe, and I've seen evidence of it, that you can go back and obtain public titles, but you express trust as the beneficiary instead of volunteering to be the surety. And so that's a long path for most people, for the condition we're in, but it's equitably sound. And we've had some good successes. You know, I'd be glad to share at some time. I think we're running out of time. I'm not sure what the time limit is. Yeah.
But yeah, because, you know, most of us don't want to go out and buy land. Most of us want to protect our land. Especially right. We're talking about the farmland that feeds everybody here. So we have to have some help, practical solutions, I think, to save the heartland here is what I'm working on.
I'd like to respond to something quickly before time goes out. You made the comment a little earlier on the thing about, you know, getting a patent on your land. There's already a patent on your land. That's how it became private property to start with. And what I do, and Robert and I do, is we help people to bring that benefit and the protective covenants of that existing patent. There's no new patent that's issued in a situation like your farm. So that's a beautiful thing about it. Every private property out there has an underlying land patent on it. That's how it got to be private property. So after the Administrative Procedures Act, they put, if I can use the illustration, a blanket over it. Now we call it real estate. That patent and benefits and protection is still there. All we have to do is file the proper papers to bring it forward in your name.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah. If I may add to that real briefly, is that they don't have a title to the real estate. The title is the land patent, and they're not allowed to hold it. So they are administering abandoned or unclaimed land or land patents. That's what they're doing. And we were able to figure that out and verify that through our homestead claims.
And that's why we don't own our land, essentially. They're considering it abandoned.
It is abandoned, and that's what the public does. When you look at it through the eyes of equity, it's all imperfect titles and volunteers, abandoned property. Those are the three main elements of commerce. So they're just a catch-all.
Abandoned property, what were the other two?
So abandoned property, imperfect titles, and volunteers. That's what's running the earth. Well, the world today.
Wow. Yeah, I get it. And that's what I've heard about, you know, basically that's what they consider us, that we're lost at sea. We are essentially not being treated as living, breathing creatures.
Which honorable man or woman would abandon their earthly estate and their private property and their rights and interests and all of that? It would have to be a human creature.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah.
Wow. Well, this has been awesome. I mean, so much to digest. We can't do this in one session.
No.
Are you going to be coming? Where is your next meeting being held? Is there someplace people could sign up and go to find this out?
Well, at American Meeting Group, .com, we have our events, but what people should do is subscribe to the email, because we have live seminar events and we have webinar events and we have other meetings and calls. And if you're a subscriber, you can be notified of all of that. And we need you to be a subscriber to be part of the PMA. And that way we're just inviting our private members.
Okay.
Great.
All right.
We'll put links
Thanks
to that.
Very
much.
Appreciate
that. Well, if you have anything else you want to impart, please do. And we'll put the links to the website below for sure.
Thank you for allowing us to be on the program.
Yeah, thank you all so much. This is great information. We really appreciate what you're doing and helping others to begin this journey. So, well, I think that was a lot of dangerous truths for today. Definitely stuff you're not going to hear on the mainstream media. This is not anything they want you to know about. But again, for our new sponsor is defythegrid.com/dangerous. And this is the way you can get they have gold in them. That's why they're different sizes. They're really cool. I actually got to see Dr. Lee's. She has one. I saw it. They're really beautiful.
And
of course, right? Yeah, they're, if nothing else, it's like an art piece. So promo code dangerous, and then rncstore.com/dangerous and promo code dangerous for your 10% off checkout. So, and we are going to be, and we're going to see if they can get some sort of an affiliate for this as well, but we are going to be at the Red Pill Expo. So,
We'll have a Dangerous Dames booth. I've got to give them a better picture. That picture's got to be 20 some years old. It doesn't look like me at all. That's me. No, it's only known by the white coat because I'm standing next to Alex Newman. That's pretty funny, actually.
That's funny. Yeah, and yeah. So you're on there. So you're going to be speaking. So yeah, and we'll get a booth. All right. Well, thank you all for watching and listening, and thank you both for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having us, and thank you for all the work you're doing out there, too. It's all part of the solution.
Amen.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.